Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Hello everyone, welcome to this special crossover episode featuring an interview with Rachel Bernstein of the Indoctrination Podcast. Now, if you haven't heard part one, I would suggest that you stop right now and head over to the Indoctrination Podcast platform, because that is actually part one, where Rachel interviewed me on her platform, and now you're about to listen to part two. So if you haven't listened to part one, maybe, yeah, pause this episode, whiz over to the Indoctrination Podcast platform, check out the first half, and then come back over here and catch the second one. Now, before we get into the interview with Rachel, I want to give you a little bit of a preview of what's coming up here in the next few episodes on Mindshift Podcast. I've got a couple of interviews waiting to come out. Now, I've talked to a guy named Trey Ferguson. He's actually a pastor out of Florida in the United States. Really interesting. Here's a guy who still considers himself a Christian, but we had a really good, respectful dialogue, really good discussion. And so that's coming out soon. Then I had another chat with another guy, another ex-pastor out of Texas named Jonathan Davis. And he and I have a lot in common. He's an ex-Bible college, ex-seminary professor, ex-pastor, and he's walked away from it all. So just interesting perspectives there. And then toward the end of this month, I've got an interview with Matthew Taylor. He's done a lot of work on the Christian right, something that obviously is a real concern of mine. If you remember the episode I did with Peter Montgomery of the Right Wing Watch, the first one that came out this January, a lot of real concerning things if you're watching the news. In fact, I just saw a poll the other day. Donald Trump is leading white evangelical voters in the United States by a big margin over the other Republican presidential candidates. So nothing really has changed in terms of the white evangelical support for Donald Trump. So anyone following the news should be absolutely concerned about these developments. And then finally, I'm working on lining up an interview with Ren Story. We've been going back and forth trying to nail down a date. I've been following her for a long time on Facebook. She's an author, an ex-evangelical like me. She's doing a lot of stuff out there trying to get her message out. So I've got an interview hopefully coming up with Ren sometime in January or early February. And then finally, we've got our Mindshift Podcast Zoom call. We did one on the 21st of January with Catherine North. She was a returning guest. She was on the show a couple months ago, back at the end of 2023. And then in February, I've got Joshua Stewart, who was also on the show toward the end of the year. And then I've actually got Jonathan Stewart coming back in the month of March. So we've got three Mindshift Zoom calls early on in the months of January, February, and March. We do these every month around about the third Sunday of the month. And these are exclusive closed calls for the Patreon supporters of the show. And in fact, speaking of Patreon supporters, I wanted to give a thank you to Mia Hamm, who became the latest Patreon supporter of the show. So a big thank you to Mia. Now, if you want to become a Patreon supporter of the show, the links, as always, are in the show notes. You can go on the Patreon page and find out what level of support you want to give and then go from there. All right, let's get on into the crossover episode part two. My interview with Rachel Bernstein of the Indoctrination Podcast. We've just finished a fantastic conversation over on the Indoctrination Podcast. Thank you, Rachel Bernstein, for, well, that great episode. If people haven't figured this out by now, this is part two. What you need to do if you're just starting here on Mindshift Podcast, you need to head over to Indoctrination, catch the first half, and then this will make more sense. So welcome, Rachel, to the show.
It is my pleasure to be here. I'm really looking forward to the next part of our conversation.
Yes, and we've done this once before. It was really good to touch base and talk about. We had a lot of things in common because we kind of both came out of the cult sort of background, controlling religion. What do you do, though, exactly for a job? Because I know you're a therapist. You do a lot of things. You'd obviously do podcasting. You know, what brings you to this show in that sense?
Right. So for a job, so my background when I was undergrad, I was studying education. And so I actually use a lot of my teaching background in what I do now with podcasting. Right after undergrad, went into what they should call overgrad, but they don't at graduate school. and then became a therapist and was already interested in cults, was already interested in it because it was interesting to me psychologically. But also I saw it as a human rights issue from early on. And just knowing there are people out there who were ready to pounce, ready to jump on people, take their life away from them. And or the others who were being born and raised in an environment that was leaving them feel when they left that they, you know, were needing to land on this planet, you know, and just being so disoriented and what that does to you. So I started early on doing this work and have continued, you know, even though I've, you know, been harassed by Scientology a bunch because that's what they like to do to show how spiritual they are. That actually fueled my fire, made me nervous when I was younger, but it fueled my fire to keep going because I knew that, you know, if they're treating me this way, I can only imagine what they're doing to people who have left and people also who have left in positions of leadership who have information that they don't want them to have. And so this is kind of nothing what they put me through. But also just hearing people's stories and caring about wanting to protect people. And that's also why I started the podcast, because after doing this work, at the time it was going on, kind of 27 years at the time. Now I've been doing it about 32 years. The guy started the podcast, 5 years ago. I remember thinking a few years before I started the podcast, I'm hearing stories I want other people to hear. It is about resilience. It's about how to heal, but it's also about what happens behind closed doors. And let's swing these doors open. Let's have people understand what these groups are really about. The ones who are out there pretending to be really something safe and they're really something not. And I wanted to protect people so that they also didn't get into something to begin with or understood that when they were leaving, that what they were experiencing was normal and to be expected and that there were others like them out there and they shouldn't have to feel so alone. So it's been a great experience. So I still do, I meet with clients. I have a support group, a few support groups actually for former cult members and some families and friends of those in cults and then do the weekly podcast. It's been really great.
One of the things that struck me when we were talking on the first half on your show, we were talking about my deconstruction from evangelical Christianity, sort of like at 30,000 feet. You know, how did I get out? What happened? It was like the thumbnail sketch. But one thing I've realized in the years that I've sort of deconstructed and reconstructed, what is it about this piece of identity? Because I have found that is such a huge, crucial piece. Because you take a person in a, let's say, high control group, whether it be religious or political cult or whatever it might be, what happens to their identity while they're part of the group? And then as they get out and they leave for whatever reason on the back end, how do they rebuild that? Why is that such an important piece of this puzzle?
Right. So identity, I mean, it's so much a part of the one of the symptoms of religious trauma. And we can talk more about what that is and the other symptoms of it. But I know sometimes when people say, what's different about the work that you do as a therapist? And I will often say that I get asked questions that a lot of other therapists don't get asked. And one of the questions is, who am I? And this is asked by people of all ages. And I've had people leaving communal living situations with a cult leader they've had their whole life in their 70s, 80s, saying, who am I? I know I need to develop a self. I don't know what that is. When you are raised somewhere also where they tell you what your worth is based on how much you do for them, how much you agree with what they say, how much you're willing to go along and how much you're willing to kind of subvert your own persona to be like them or be an empty vessel for the teachings and the personalities there. And then you are not going to know who you are. You have to develop that later on, and we can talk maybe a little bit about how I try to help people with that. But also you're told how you're supposed to be feeling and what you're supposed to be thinking and what you're not supposed to be thinking. And also that your natural drives are evil. All of it is so disorienting in the negative. And also that you are supposed to look down on the rest of the world, but within the group, you're looked down on. because you're being watched and you're being criticized. And, you know, when do you get to see eye to eye with anyone? So that's just to begin with. And so it's a lot to need to conquer. And it's not an impossible thing. But one of the things that gets in the way is when you leave because you've been told that you're doing something tremendously wrong, or it's of the devil or whatever else that you left, not having a sense of self-worth and confidence is the thing that sometimes gets in the way of building a self, at least to begin with, because you think, do I even deserve to be happy? Or could any of my thoughts or any of my feelings ever be right? Because I've learned to not trust myself. And so you have to overcome that stumbling block to even start to begin to develop a self that you feel at all, even semi-sure about.
Mm. And I can remember as a kid, there's so many things that resonate with what you're just saying. I mean, religious trauma syndrome, having things like rapture anxiety. I was absolutely convinced that the rapture was going to happen and I was going to be left behind. You know, so it's like a soldier in combat. I'm expecting death and destruction at any moment, you know, and Jesus is coming like a thief in the night. It could be tonight. Am I ready? I don't think I'm ready. You know, what kind of damage does that do to a kid of 10, 12, 11, you know, years of age? That's so damaging on just so many levels, isn't it? How can you sort of reconstruct after that years and years of that sort of context, that trauma, and we're just filled with anxiety? And even now, I'm in my late 50s now, and I still have, like, I can start to feel the anxiety gripping me, not about the rapture, but just when I get in situations that are stressful. And I think, and how much of that goes back to those kind of scenarios when I was a kid growing up in that fundamentalist church?
Right. So, you know, when you were saying it impacts you on so many levels, so it does. It impacts you emotionally. It impacts you physiologically. Because if you are in a panic state, then you are releasing adrenaline a lot of the time, which is exhausting. And you get used to slipping into that way too easily, too. Just the tiniest thought can send you right into a panic state because you're so used to being there. I think also feeling like you're not sure that you're going to have any future at all, then you don't plan for one. And so you don't really even know how to take the steps to make something of yourself in your life. I mean, forget about the women who just already have it dictated for them that they're going to be wives and mothers, and that's it, a lot of the time, right? Homemakers or stay-at-home daughters, whatever it is. And then for the men, how do you know sort of even how to build on the steps that you need to take to have a career, to get an education, if you don't know if you're going to be here from one day to the next, or even if the world is going to be here from one day to the next?
That's true. Yeah. Jesus is coming soon. He's going to burn it all down, create a whole new heaven and earth. What do we need to worry about? A lot of Christians don't care about the environment because, you know, God's going to burn it all up. Why should we care? We mentioned when we were talking on your show, we were talking about the whole Doug Wilson thing out of Moscow, Idaho, the Christian patriarchy movement, the manosphere, the beard bros and all these guys. And this has been a message that probably resonated in the last 15 or 20, maybe 30 years, that this Christian muscular, masculine sort of thing going on. Guys like Mark Driscoll, Mars Hill in Seattle, and John Piper and other people, Doug Wilson. But what does it do to a woman? I mean, you must have clients that come out of those kind of controlling environments where it's super patriarchal in terms of their identity, their own development. How does it affect a woman in that sort of situation?
What it does to a woman when, yet again, the needs of the men are being addressed over and over and over again, because somehow they're being having their rights and their power taken away. And the women are like, we didn't ever notice that because life didn't change for us, right? Yeah. So like, when was that movement, you know, but now they're feeling really threatened by this thing that we never noticed because everything was the same for us and we were still second-class citizens. But now they're wanting to even be stronger and feel more empowered. What does that mean for us? Typically, that means more control, more abuse, and more things that are going to happen that are going to limit our lives while men's lives get bigger, more robust, and more powerful. And that there's more permission given then for mistreatment of the woman because it's a way that a man shows he's a man. And that is very frightening because that's often the equation. And so women get actually frightened when they see these movements because they know life is going to go from hard to being harder. And so a lot of women will say to me that they grew up being made to feel like they cannot be trusted, that they are harlots, that they are sirens, that they are these figures that are going to tempt men. And that's true in kind of orthodoxy with, you know, many different religions and, you know, to a great degree, even though within Orthodox Judaism, the woman is revered in a lot of ways. She is the one who is, you know, helping with bringing future generations forward and carrying on a tradition. But still, you know, she has to pray silently while a man can pray out loud because, you know, she can't distract and she needs to cover her hair. The whole thing where, you know, a lot of people will who are not religious say, well, how come the boys and the men are just not told to have self-control so the women don't have to modify what they're doing all the time? That message seems to get lost because that might feel too difficult because men are men and boys will be boys and all those adages that really don't apply and are giving people a pass. But I think women also have a sense that their bodies are things that are kind of in danger and are going to cause them danger. And that a lot of women too will talk about how they were made to feel like that they had the issues around sexuality brought up by men and also by women, by older women or by their mothers or fathers, way more often than it was ever on their minds. Sometimes now when people have left, they're thinking, why was sex on everyone's mind all the time? They said it was on my mind, right? And I needed to be careful and I needed to not dress this way. And I'm thinking, no, I wasn't even, I was thinking it's hot. That's why I want to wear shorts. I'm not thinking about sex. I'm 12. But why is it on everyone else's mind all the time? And so there was like this overly sexualized concentration of thought and focus that made, you know, I think the girls and the women feel very uncomfortable a lot of the time, needlessly so, and the whole purity culture, all of that, which is really totally unnecessary.
Yeah, that's the context I was raised in. We talked about on your show, I was raised by my parents who subscribed to Bill Gothard. If anyone's seen that Shiny Happy People, I wasn't as bad in the sense we weren't homeschooled like the Duggars were and other families in that. There's the ATI, the Advanced Training Institute that Gothard had. But that's the purity, modesty culture was a huge component of Gothard's teaching. And you see that in the Duggars, you know, these girls wearing these, you know, ankle length dresses and had their hair a certain way and it felt very culty, you know. Real FLDS sort of vibes coming out of there, you know? And that's the same dynamic though. Like it's not just relegated to fundamentalist Christianity. You see it in Mormonism. You see it in fundamentalist Islam, Judaism. It's a thing in these sort of controlling fundamentalist iterations of religion, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, there are people who have connected with each other who were raised in these environments who said they're the only ones who had to wear what they called prairie dresses. And some of them went to public school and were ostracized, were made fun of. I mean, it was a terribly difficult time, especially, you know, if you're young or if a teenager, you don't want to be standing out in that way. And you don't even quite know why you have to look this way and dress this way and why that means that somehow you're going to be safer or that God is going to be happier with you. A lot of those messages just don't make sense when you bring them down to those kinds of equations.
Yeah. And as you say, the women and girls end up being the victims 9 times out of 10, because for a lot of reasons, they know that they'll be blamed for, quote unquote, leading the man astray. I mean, look at just the Southern Baptist Convention. We had that report that came out a few years ago, over 700 documented cases of clergy abuse in Southern Baptist Convention churches. What have they done with that in the last couple of years? They've doubled down, they've denied, they voted in more stringent, you know, sort of dogmas about keeping it the way it is. We're not going to change. We don't see any problem here. Rather than opening up and saying, okay, guys, we have a serious systemic problem in our churches nationwide, potentially worldwide. Nope. They've just doubled down, you know? So this is what the men in charge of the Southern Baptist Convention are doing. What's the Catholic Church done in cases of clergy abuse? They've moved the priest to another parish. They've not told anybody. He's then free to continue abusing. And the pattern just repeats and repeats.
Right. Absolutely right. And I think, you know, even though the focus, as I'm talking about it now, to answer your question, is about women, about girls, I have also treated some men who were raised, you know, and got the message when they were boys that women's feelings didn't matter and that they could never be trusted. And that if you had any feeling, any physiological impact from, let's say, being attracted to a woman, that was something she was doing to you. And you could then take that out on her. And it was that, you know, that some of them dealt with then having abuse charges laid on them when they came out into the world outside, because they had no idea what the social norms are, what the legal statutes are, that, you know, what is okay and what's not okay. And they had to develop this sense that women are human too, in the same way that they are. And that was just unknown to them. So, you know, it's really, you're not doing any favors to either gender or any gender.
It really warps your view of sexuality on, like you say, so many levels, doesn't it? Because I can see as a kid, it definitely did mine. Because ironically, you know, pornography was one of the big things. You know, it's still, I mean, Mike Johnson just said when he became the Speaker of the House, he confessed that he had this covenant software, you know, him and his son. That's a thing in evangelicalism. You know, pornography is such a taboo thing. You can't, you know, pastors have gotten sacked. They've gotten fired for admitting that they've, you know, looked at pornography and all that. And as a kid, I can remember wrestling with it. But, you know, this normal sexual urges are now interpreted as a thought crime against God. And you look at a woman lustfully, it's just as much as you've had sex with her. That's what Jesus taught in the gospel, you know. So, man, it messes up your view of women's sexuality. So, yeah, it can be a very destructive thing, can it?
Yes. And you know, the message also that comes across is that if you access pornography, then you're doing something sinful. But if you molest someone, you might just get moved to another church.
That's right. Confusing, to right? Say the least. Not seriously messed up.
Right. So people who were raised in some of these churches will say that they were molested by the pastor, by the choir director, by the camp counselor, by the teacher who had a history of it, who was just brought to that campus for what reason. I don't know why they thought that would be a good idea, but that they could get in a huge amount of trouble, or their sisters would, let's say, if their skirt was 1 inch too short. So, you know, nothing makes sense. Nothing is equal.
That's crazy. And then on the flip side, like we mentioned, the Southern Baptist, we talked a little bit about Doug Wilson on your show. He's another one. He's got a history of protecting abusers, known abusers of girls in his school and people in his church. So that's another dark side of this whole thing, that not only will the woman be blamed and perhaps the parents as well, but then the abuser will be left to continue abusing and defended by those in charge. You know, he's a good, well, look at right now, this is a breaking story. And it may be ended by the time this podcast dropped, but Mike Bickle, IHOP Kansas City, the big massive mega prayer church in Kansas City. He's being credibly accused of grooming and basically molesting multiple women. He's denied the whole thing and the typical story, you know, so that's another one, another high profile evangelical who's being defended and his church refuses to look into it. Like, you know, you cannot question a man of God. Look at what he's done for us and look how much he's done for the kingdom. That's what happened to Rabbi Zacharias and so many. You can just, there's a laundry list of people, isn't there, that have been protected and then been free to continue abusing.
Right. There's like, we're going to pile on. And yeah, another thing.
Just keep adding more.
Right. And it's a sad thing that there's just more and more and more to add here. But it is true for the people who have gone through forced conversion therapy and exorcisms because of the way they were born. And that for some of the people I've talked to, some of the people who were doing the forced conversion therapy to un-gay the gay,
pray the gay away.
I like that.
Make them straight.
Right, exactly. And forget about being trans. I mean, just, it must be just a miserable thing. But that some of the people recognize the people doing this forced conversion therapy, I hate to call it therapy, it's really not, it's torture, or the exorcisms, as being people who had molested children. And here they were in this position of needing to exorcise kind of the demon out of someone else. And they couldn't say, being gay, lesbian, bi, whatever they were born being, that somehow this was a person who was given dominion, going back to a word we use on my show that you use, being given dominion over them and to decide what is okay about them and what's not, when they have not lived their lives that way, following what's right and what's wrong. So it is very hard to just deal with any of that and come out, you know, needing to address kind of redoing the beliefs, but for a lot of people also needing to get over some trauma.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe this is the last subject we can touch on. This all relates somehow to religious trauma syndrome, doesn't it? Everything we've been describing somehow falls under that umbrella. Can you define what actually is religious trauma syndrome in your experience? And what are some of the symptoms that you see? And then maybe touch on some of the treatments that you found that are more effective for people with RTS.
Right. So I'm glad that you're bringing this up. I think one of the things that is difficult at first is for people who just feel very down on themselves. They have been taught often from a young age that they're worthless, that they can't trust themselves, and that they need to be dependent on a leader to guide them because they don't have the ability to guide themselves. So they leave not realizing how much strength they have, how much they can access their own critical thinking, how much they can trust their own interpretation of things. So they're feeling that handicapped in that way. Then also a lot of nightmares and sleeping issues, because you're given these visuals of what's going to happen to you, what's going to happen to the world. You know, I think about people raised Jehovah's Witness who are given these tracts, these illustrated books from a young age about, you know, the fires of hell coming through cracks in the sidewalk. And, you know, and that's your bedtime story. So,
yeah. Right. Not good for the kiddies.
Right. Exactly. So a lot of them who I've worked with say they sense that there's a demon at the edge of their bed, tugging on their sheets, and, you know, and they think there's something wrong with them until they start talking to each other and they say, oh, no, actually, that happened to me, too. Absolutely. Yes. I think it's also hard to know, first of all, if you can trust yourself, but then who else you can trust. How do you build strong relationships? You've been sort of sequestered a lot of the time from the rest of the world. Will you be accepted by the world? Can you find a way in? Are you going to be seen as kind of quote unquote normal enough to not be isolated for the rest of your life and not have to worry about that? Making friendships is sometimes just hard to do because you're also used to talking about very heavy issues. So I've heard from a lot of former members who will say, I don't know how to do small talk. Like, I don't know how to go on a date and just talk about the weather, talk about, you know, sports. I have no idea. I don't know about modern culture. I haven't seen a movie that was not rated G. And so I don't know.
Probably religious. Yeah.
Right. And it was religious. Right. And in fact, some of the people who I talked to also were shown other movies that were not at all rated G, but there was a purpose for that, that they were supposed to be scared into not doing something because of it.
That was me, yeah. A Thief in the Night and even The Passion of the Christ. You know, that was an extremely gory, violent movie. Some people said it might have been rated X just because of the violence and the gore, the gratuitous violence and everything. What was the point of that? But it's very traumatizing, isn't it? Then you think, I mean, little kids were taken to see that film. For what purpose? You know, this is what Jesus went through on the cross for us. And, you know, we need to be thankful and love God and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean,
right.
That will mess a kid up.
Yes, it will. And that's just another example of how so many things happen to children in these groups that are not developmentally appropriate for them at their ages, where they really are exposed to things beyond what is okay and ideas beyond what is okay for that age, for that level of maturity and ability to handle the information. So there's a lot of post-trauma that people are dealing with too when they come out of this. And then I think also another major issue is decision-making skills. So how do you make a decision and stick with it and feel like it's okay and it's not going to be punishable in some spiritual way? And, you know, that's a very difficult thing, just to be decisive in any way.
It's true, because I can remember being paralyzed as a Christian for so many reasons. You don't want to make the wrong decision that's, quote, outside of God's will, because not only could you suffer consequences, as you say, in the world to come, But even in this life, God can punish you for doing the wrong thing, for stepping out of his will. So a lot of Christians don't make big decisions, or they wait and wait and wait, agonizing over what the right thing is to do because they don't know what God's will is. And then when you leave that, like you say, it's really difficult to have that sense of agency, I think, and go, okay, I can make decisions. I can do the best I can, get all the information, make the best decision I think I need to make here, but I'm also willing to deal with whatever consequences come with that. That's part of the decision, isn't it? If something goes badly wrong, then I've got to be able to live with that and deal with that. But that's part of taking responsibility, isn't it?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I think then lastly, and I know we'll move on to the how to help people with this part, but and again, there are more symptoms, but I just want to make sure to mention this one, that when people are coming out of these kinds of situations, a lot of the time, because they were raised believing that there's only one right way to believe, and that's where God is, that's God was at my church, not anyone else's, there is really this nervousness about getting involved in anything else, any other church, any other, even other religion, thinking, well, it's false. I mean, I don't have any other choices. And that there isn't a choice also for a lot of people to be agnostic or to be atheist. I remember telling someone that I was agnostic, and they said, well, then how do you know not to murder people? Wow, that was a leap.
But let's go straight there.
Okay. Because it's horrible and illegal, but also I would never do that because it's immoral. It's a lot of other things, and I don't need God to tell me that, you know?
But yeah, no moral compass.
Exactly.
That's a classic one. You don't have a faith, so you have no moral. You're just going to go out and rob and murder and steal and sleep around and do drugs and everything. I mean, what? Where's the limit, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Because what is true when you're raised in these environments is that you have an external locus of control. And so you assume that you always need that you always need someone to tell you what's right and what's wrong, that somehow you don't have an internal compass, but you often do. I mean, unless you're a sociopath, which is a tiny percentage of the population, luckily.
Yeah, there are out there, but yeah, very rare, really, isn't it?
Very rare, like 0.0, whatever, very rare, very luckily. But people do often have an internal compass. And even if it comes from them saying, like, do unto others, if I don't like that someone is coming over and knocking me down to the ground and that feels bad and that injures my body, then I've learned I'm not going to do that to somebody else. Like, you can develop, you know, and God didn't come in and teach me that. That was from my own life experience.
The golden rule.
Right. Exactly right. So I think a lot of people think that they're left without choices for a spiritual community, or that they're left without the choice of not believing at all in the same way or not believing in God. But that is always an option, and people shouldn't feel like now they're without any.
All right, we've got a few minutes left. Can you give us some top tips on some of the best ways you found to treat religious trauma syndrome? What are some of the more effective strategies you discovered?
Okay, first, you want to understand the language of what happened to you. You want to understand what trauma is and that you were traumatized, if that's what you're experiencing, and why you're having your nightmares, why you're having panic attacks, why you're nervous about life in general, why you're not trusting yourself, how that worked for the group to teach you that about yourself or to make you believe that about yourself, but that it wasn't true about you. And so you want to understand why you were taught these things and how it worked to help to control the masses, but wasn't necessarily authentically true. And also, if you were abused, what abuse is, because abuse is called other things in fundamentalist groups. It's not called abuse. Neglect, medical neglect, emotional neglect, not being sent to a therapist, not being put on medication, that is neglect. And it's not to strengthen you, and it's not to teach you about something else. So you want to get the definitions. So to understand the language, so you can get help for those things, then you can go to a trauma-informed therapist because you know that's what you went through, or someone who specializes in abuse. I think also you want to have a sense of yourself in a non-religious way. Like, again, who am I? What are my strengths? What are my interests? What have I always found myself drawn to that I was never able to do? What do I think I'm good at that was probably put down by the church as being frivolous or something else? And what can I get into that really will help me develop me and have a sense of me? You also want to get connected to a support group, to others, to people who have had similar experiences. So you realize you're not alone and you're in very good company. You're going to have actually millions of other people who have been through something. And so you should never, ever feel alone. And look at what you believe and why you believe it, especially the things that you've come to believe about yourself. And be willing to redo them if they really don't fit anymore, especially if they are defamatory, especially if they make you feel small, especially if they make you feel bad, or if they hinder you and your confidence building in any way. So I think those are good places to start.
Good start. Yeah, some great resources, isn't it? I mean, I think you're right. One of the most helpful resources I found was just going online. When I was first getting out of the church and becoming an, I didn't know the word ex-evangelical. I found some Facebook groups. I found some support groups on Twitter. Well, it was then Twitter, you know, and I connect with people worldwide. And like you said, what I found right away was A, this isn't the only, I'm not the only one that's, this has happened to. B, I'm not crazy. C, there are tens of thousands, millions of us, and there's all kinds of other groups out there. So yeah, there is a huge community. You just need to find that community. It's true. That's one of the massive resources we can develop. Okay, so last question then. We talked about the first half of the show was on Indoctrination Podcast. How can people find you on social media if they want to connect with you? What's the best place to do that?
A new episode comes out every Wednesday, just like on your show. So you can find me on Twitter or X, you know, and Instagram, Facebook, a lot of other places. You can email me at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. If you want to check out the work that I do and any other resources, I have some free PDFs on my website for people who are looking just for information when they've come out of a group or when they have a loved one who's involved in something and they want to know how to reach them. You can check out my website at rachelbernsteintherapy.com. And there you can also find out about the support groups and about if you want to come and speak with me or even Zoom with me for some kind of counseling or consulting. And I think, yeah, if you want to just check out the podcast, it's, I believe it's on every platform now, so you can find it. And it's Indoctrination.
We covered a lot of ground in the two episodes, but they were, a lot of it was interrelated, wasn't it? We touched base on a lot of things. So I'm interested to hear what people's feedback is on not just this episode, but the one on your platform too. So thank you so much, Rachel. I've thoroughly enjoyed doing this crossover episode. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me. And thanks for all of your good work and all the research you've done and your books and just all that you're putting out for the public. It's really exciting and really, really necessary.
It's a lot of work. But yeah, I'm pouring my heart and soul into it like you do too. So we will do this again. I'm sure we'll touch base again. Let's maybe not make it another 2 years, but we'll do it again. Thank you so much, Rachel.
My pleasure. Thank you.